So you've been visiting these other institutions that are working in many ways more practically, mm-hmm. both the Nobel Institute, of course, with the prizes, but they're also hosting both laureates and scholars and things sort of throughout the year. But their main focus, obviously, is the, you know, the legacy of Alfred Nobel and the Peace Prize. And happy to also give you sort of a little bit of additional, if there's any questions that arose after, you know, the ceremony, if you wonder, I can probably expand on that a little bit. And then the Nobel Peace Center, which of course has all of the you know, communication, all of the responsibility for promoting the legacy of Nobel and the Peace Prize through the exhibitions. Mm-hmm. And the Oslo Center, which has a little bit of sort of a hybrid role, but trying to also be a place for more kind of policy action, but also meeting, you know, a meeting place for various audiences. PRIO is the oldest peace research institute in the world. We were established back in 1959, so we celebrated 60 years here back in 2019. And it's a private foundation, a non-profit, and it's an academic institution. So we are not, we're primarily getting our income from academic funders, so Research Council of Norway, which is comparable to the National Science Foundation in the US, and then from some European major funders, that's European Research Council, and then we have some funding from the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Norway, the Minister of Defense, Minister of Justice, and some funding from international organizations like the UN, so UNDP, sometimes the World Bank, but then even if we're an academic institution, which means that we're, you know, our funders are primarily interested in whether we are doing academic research and publishing our research in academic journals. It's important for us that we try to get the content of our research, so the gist of our research, out to a much broader audience than just the academic audience. Right. So we want to make sure that the insights that we're producing, and some of it, you know, can be, you know, some of the stuff that we're publishing can be quite technical and quite inaccessible because it's, you know, it comes with the genre of you know, the pure social anthropologist you publish in certain journals, and that may be incomprehensible to me who's a political scientist. And so there are these disciplinary boundaries, and there are, you know, certainly I'm doing statistical work, and some of that is certainly inaccessible to people who don't necessarily have a statistical training. So what we're trying to do is that we're communicating sort of the findings of our work through policy briefs, through meetings, engagements with policymakers. We have you know, close collaboration with the UN organizations. We are working with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. We're working with several Global South partners and Global North partners, in both academic and non-academic, so that we both you know, make sure that we're building on a much larger network than just those researchers based here, and that we're also connecting to people and to organizations who are actually active on the ground. And then there is one exception to the sort of the academic focus of PRIO, and that's we have our center in Cyprus, in Nicosia, and Cyprus is a divided country and has been since the 1970s when Turkey invaded the north, so it's split between a Turkish Cypriot part and a Greek Cypriot part, and that conflict has been going nowhere
for a
very long time, and it's been a frozen conflict, so no one's actually died there for you know, in combat since the 1970s, but there has been just no result to that conflict.
So you actually set up down there?
We have a center set up there, which is funded by the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Norway, because they have had a particular interest in trying to contribute to solve that conflict. Mm-hmm. And since Norway doesn't have an embassy in Cyprus, we have also been sort of their areas and arms on the ground and contributing to providing for a meeting place. And so that's really where, an example where some of the research we're doing is contributing directly into trying to in these days when facts have become
right.
relative in a sense of objective truths not being as objective as we mm-hmm. thought they were. Mm-hmm. Trying to establish what are the demographics on the ground, what is happening with political movements, what's the situation for you. So Prios researchers down at the center, when they're both Greek Cypriot and Turkish Cypriot, trying to simply get the empirics right and say this is the situation on the ground, how you solve it politically is up to you, but we have to find a way to establish what the actual
are they actually is. Sitting down at the table and talking with each other.
I wish I could say they were, but of course, I mean, we were trying to infuse that process with some knowledge, and that's the idea.
It's important
and it's so hard.
So just kind of rerunning over what's going on is you're finding facts about just certain conflicts and stuff like that, and using research based on like peace strategies, and then giving them to councils and stuff like that. Is that what's going
on? Yeah, I mean, broadly, that's what's going on. So we are extremely we're broad in the sense of what we're focusing on. So if we take what's going on at Prio is we have very international staff. We have a staff of about 100 full-time positions, of which 80 are researchers, 20 are support staff. But we have many people in part-time positions. They have a main affiliation with the university, and then they have a 20% position, so secondary position here. So if you count the number of people on our payroll in a given year, it's between 150 and 160. We have a lot of PhD students, and almost half of all our staff here are non-Norwegian, and they come from all over the place. So that also means that we have a lot of PhD students, for instance, coming from conflict areas. We have a PhD student working on Myanmar, who's a Myanmari. Mm-hmm. We have an Afghani PhD student, Somali. One of my students she came as a refugee to Norway from Liberia. I think we still have a Colombian PhD student. From a lot of different conflict areas.
Right.
So they bring with them both the knowledge of the situation on the ground and the language skills that are required.
So yeah, that's Indian as well. Potentially so rich that you're getting people from other conflict areas that can bring their what they've seen and what they've experienced to the table to try to do some problem solving. Yeah. Now, since it's a research institute, and that's depending on what the focus, the disciplinary focus is, it's different types of research, but can you tell us some things that Prio has discovered that may be new and groundbreaking?
There's plenty of that, and I can give you a handful of examples. We have a large project now, it's too early to point to any specific discoveries, but it's in terms of perspectives, I think it is really changing a lot of changing the focus in a way that I think is important. And that's a large migration project where we're looking at how, because this is particularly focusing on West Africa and the fact that 40-50% of young people in many of these countries in West Africa ideally would want to migrate to Europe, but only a relatively small portion are able to do so or attempting to do so. But one key question is, what does it do to their prospects about the future, and what does it do to their way that they plan for their futures in their home countries when you know, the ultimate goal may be to try to migrate, because then you may not consider, you know, investing in your local community. May mean that you're putting off education. May mean that you're putting off, you know, establishing a family. And so this is, you know, one of the perspectives we're usually, you know, focusing on how migration is happening, how to make it safe, and we're doing a lot of work on that as well. But it really is. It's a much broader question also in terms of, you know, individual and development of societies, because it has huge impacts on the way that both individuals and societies
act. Well, it destabilizes the society they're in.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Both destabilizing, but also in a way sort of leads to an underinvestment. And we see this also in conflict countries, and that's another thing that we've worked on. You know, we talk about conflict happening in countries, but in reality, conflicts are happening in relatively sort of small areas within countries. But the problem is that when we learn that, you know, Nigeria is a conflict country, that is something that discourages investments in much larger areas.
Sure.
Right. So people are, you know, they won't necessarily go forward with an investment in a country that has a conflict, even though it has no impact on, you know, in the areas where they would normally operate. So that's another, you know, area that we're trying to also engage directly with businesses, trying to tell them, you know, there are some areas that we know where conflict is happening, because we are collecting data together with the University of Uppsala on exact locations of conflict, and so we can tell what areas within countries that have a high risk of conflict and which have a low risk of conflict, and then, you know, say to businesses that these areas within these countries really have a very low risk of conflict, and it's possible to you know, to go there and to invest and to contribute.
Are you finding in West Africa that most of those young folks who are migrating are returning to the place of origin of colonialism?
That's a good question. I think many are. So what we know is that people are following the tracks that already exist, right? In the sense that where there is, you know, networks, either family or friends, or you know, it's much easier to navigate towards those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, part of that historical legacy is of course colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also, you know, there's quite a bit of migration into countries, European countries, that don't have that kind of colonial history.
Okay.
So of course you have Great Britain, and you have France, and you have Belgium and Netherlands, which have these very sort of strong historical ties.
Right.
But you also have both Sweden and Germany. Germany has a, you know, much much smaller colonial history that are more sort of recent paths of migration. But we see that in Norway as well. You know, that there are certain certain groups that tend to come to Norway more precisely because there is, you know, there are family ties, there are and even come from the same, many come from the same villages, right? So so you can see that there is a path dependency. Another area which I think is where PRIO research has done a little bit of difference is the whole discussion about climate change and conflict, which we actually try to make people think twice about, because it's quite often overstated as a source of armed conflict, and this is something that we think is important to communicate, because we've done research on this area for a long time, because climate change is going to be an enormously influential factor in terms of human security, and then we talked about not conventional security, but talking about, you know, the risk that it plays in people's lives, including as one factor that is, you know, contributing to migration, but as a direct or sort of a factor affecting conflict risk, it's actually surprisingly unimportant as a driver. And I'm worried about the way that the whole debate about climate change and conflict is stereotyping also migration and securitizing migration, because one of the key linkages between climate change and conflict is claimed to be, you know, the fact that people are migrating, we know from a lot of research that migration in itself is not something that is causing armed conflict. We should be a little bit careful about not sort of overemphasizing that relationship, because it's not empirically correct. B, it's creating all kinds of stereotypes about migrants causing conflict, and that has some political implications.
Right.
I think we should be, you know, at least aware.
I think the fact that it's coupled at all was not an accident.
Sorry, the fact
that the climate refugees and conflict are being coupled at all was not an accident.
No, it's not an accident. And you can trace it back to the end of the Cold War, where the militaries in the Western countries were also looking for new rationales for this is a historical legacy, and much has happened since then, but of course it was propelled by also some kind of rationale on the part of the military. But I think one of my major concerns is that there are so many different factors that affects people's decision to move. If you look at many countries in sub-Saharan Africa, the proportion of urban dwellers is very low. It's, you know, between 30% and 40%. In most of your, you know, European countries, it's between 80% and 90%. And the reason why people are moving to cities is it's absolutely rational. If you move from the countryside to the city, you have a higher likelihood of getting an income. Even though even if you live in a sort of a slum area in poor living conditions, you have a higher income, better access to healthcare, better access to education, better access to networks. So it's a rational thing, but it's also something that is contributing to economic, social, political development. And if the answer to climate change is that we should prevent people from moving to the cities, I think that's completely sort of counterproductive. So this is what I'm trying to tell Nora. It's what I'm trying to tell, you know, when I talk about climate change and conflict, is that at least we need to be we need to see the nuances here, and we need to acknowledge the part or the aspects of climate change that poses a threat to human security. And I think one of the major problems, actually, when it comes to climate change and conflicts, is the other way around. It's the way that conflicts make people much more vulnerable to climate change. Because it's if you're in the middle of an armed conflict, there's just no way you can adapt. There's no way you can, you know, make sure that you have food security. So there are some important linkages, but not necessarily the ones that we tend to focus on the most.
Yeah.
So
could you, in a nutshell, like, walk us through like the process from finding about an area that may have conflict to like the research that you do? What kind of steps do you do? Because I feel like that's important for us, like on a smaller scale, so like we can apply it to family relationships, but yeah, how do you go about
it? So that's a great question, because we work on this from very many different angles. So we have those who work with statistics and trying to, you know, capture from year to year where exactly are the conflicts happening and what should we expect in terms of, you know, what's next, where is conflict moving from here.
Could I add this in there as well?
Sure.
If you want to clarify what kind of PhD focuses you have working with you.
Yeah. And that's it's and the reason why I'm laughing is because it's such a broad question, and it's so Prio is so we are very much a bottom up driven organization. So okay. I'm as a leader, I don't get to decide what people should work on, because they're all developing their own projects, and it's an extremely rich at university. They have in some sense a strategic decision about, you know, now we're going to set aside the funding to focus on these areas. You know, climate change is important, migration is important, livelihoods is important. At Prio, because we are a private foundation, only 15% of our funding is 13% is a core grant from the state. All the remaining income will have to be earned every year from developing grants, which means that
you're always scrambling for money.
We're always scrambling for money. I mean, we've been doing this forever, so it's something we're quite good at. But it's we need to develop that project that some funder is willing to pay for, and that means that, you know, we have these ideas about what are the most important conflicts, what are the most important areas thematically to work on, and we're trying to, you know, create a project for a funder, whether that's the Research Council, you know, the NSF in Norway, or the European Union, and we try to, you know, promote that and say, and usually it's calls out, and so also the funders are deciding, you know, this year we want to focus on migration, this year we want to focus on climate change, whatever. But we are we're not always getting our projects funded. Basically, we have to try to be innovative and say that, you know, we want to focus on something we think you should really fund. But it's entirely up to the funder, and sometimes it can take forever to get the project funded. One of my projects, which looks at how conflict affects maternal and child health, is a project that we submitted six times before it was funded. Wow. So we waited for 6 years before it was eventually, and we improved it every year. But it's you know, that's a way that it works. You have to develop these projects and then find a way to fund it. And if you don't get that funding, you'll have to move to something else and, you know, talk to the Minister of Foreign Affairs or, you know, find some other funder. So that means that, you know, the strategic ambition is to try to say, you know, we have these areas that we really want to try to focus on and get funding for, but if we get we may not get funding for this particular project in this particular year, we may have to wait, you know, until the relevant call comes out, or just, you know, it comes down to luck sometimes if you get a project funded. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to identify, you know, collectively and in small groups, what are the, you know, the really new areas that we have to focus on. Of course, to some extent, it's presenting itself when you have a major conflict breaking out in Syria. We are trying to respond to that by saying, you know, we need some research on this. Mm-hmm. We may go to the Minister of Foreign Affairs because they can act more quickly. Yeah. They can, you know, they can sometimes say, you know, we think this is so important. That was happened after what happened after Ukraine, mm-hmm. when Russia invaded Ukraine. The Minister of Foreign Affairs reached out to us and say, we need to know how this conflict is going to affect food security in the global south. And so we had researchers who had competence on that and could, you know, start pretty much the next day and say, we can make a report because we've been researching this on climate change and food security. And
excellent.
So that's the way it works, right? So we can then take, and we are quite flexible. We don't teach. We're not a degree granting institution, so we can shift, you know, our tasks around, focus around a little bit. Again, when someone has to be willing to pay for it. That's our limitation. So if, you know, if we say we really want to focus on the war in Myanmar, and no one has the funding to provide for that, our hands are tied in the sense that we don't have any funding to do it. And that can be frustrating because some of the conflicts that are really intense, some of the major things that are happening in the world, aren't really on the agenda of the policymakers,
right.
And so
right.
There isn't the one-to-one. So Ukraine, boof, you know, everything's
right.
Happening at the same time, a lot of funding available, but I mean, many more people were killed in Syria over the years.
Right. Do you have anyone working in research in regards to the famine happening in Somalia?
We have people working on the Somali conflict, including a Somali a young man who actually grew up partly in the Dadaab, the Dadaab camp in Kenya,
mm-hmm.
And to move to Sweden. He came to Sweden as a refugee and is doing now work on livelihoods and conflict in Somalia.
Wow.
Or in the Somaliland area. But no one working on the famine as of right now.
It was wild. I had no clue it was even happening. Mm. You know, it was happening. There's a lot of information being shared about the famine right when Ukraine, the conflict was happening, and was sort of being like shoved down, I felt.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
No, and that's that is the problem, right? The attention span and the attention of media, and especially in our countries, isn't really, you know, isn't balanced in the sense of giving the most attention to the humanitarian crisis that are the most important, necessary.
Right. Yeah.
And so that is part of our responsibility as well, to try to focus on all of these areas that aren't getting attention.
It's tough work.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, if no one's willing to listen to that and say that, you know, this is important, but again, some of our long-term funders, so we have projects now in Myanmar, we have projects in Colombia, we have projects on Somalia, on the DRC. So a lot of these conflicts are, you know, forgotten. But yeah, but I mean, it's there are a number of huge challenges, and that no one's paying, you know, proper attention.
Right.
To. Yeah.
Right. I saw that you guys have like a seminar hall that we were in when you came to see us. How often do you have guest speakers come through? Or
almost all the time.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, almost every day. And sometimes multiple meetings a day. Yeah. You should sign up for the PRIO list. Many of the or several of the meetings are recorded. So we do it either an audio file or sometimes a full. But we want to make sure it's, you know, if we put something out, it should be sufficient quality.
Right.
So last week we had the what we call the PRIO annual peace address, and this is something we're doing every year, and we have an international speaker come and talk about a topic. So this year we had a Serbian pro-democracy activist called Serja Popovic, who's an absolutely amazing person. He was one of the student leaders in the late 1990s who contributed to topple Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia. So he was in the middle of it. Now he's running an organization called Canvas, which is an organization working with non-violent methods, training student movements, training other social movements in how to use non-violent in as a political tool. They've been engaged in more than 60 countries worldwide.
Jeez.
You know, and he was online with some Iranians now on Friday, on Saturday. So he's training them, talking about, you know, what can the strategies be that we're using to nonviolently challenge the Iranian regime. He's working with people from Myanmar. He's been working with people from Zimbabwe. So he's all over the place and absolutely amazing work they're doing. He did a lot of work during the Arab Spring with the movements, student movements there. Working only non-violently, and we know from research, there's another sort of insight that is quite interesting, is that non-violent movements have a much higher likelihood of achieving real political change than political violent groups. I think that's quite mind-boggling and important.
I mean, it makes sense, because politics is rarely ever violent. It is very manipulative in a way, just manipulating words, manipulating laws, things like that. Mm. So if you're able to present something in front of somebody without, put it this way, one of the best definitions I feel like I've come up with, persuasion, is not making somebody feel like you're getting them to do something, it's making them feel like they want to do something. And so if you go at it from that approach, you know, put it in their shoes. Okay, everybody agrees with humanity, you know, treating somebody as a human. If they feel that sense of emotion, you can get them to feel that about their family or something like that, to where they feel it, then I feel like you can go a long way.
To what extent is your research country-specific or broadly targeted in terms of, are there overreaching themes to your research that apply to all countries as opposed to simply what's going on in a specific location?
And what I've always found to be so super interesting about PRIO is that there is a good mix of both the general and especially some of the statistical work. And I come myself from a background as a quantitatively oriented political scientist. So I've done much of my research has been looking at the whole world and what is triggering conflict. What can we say about the general causes? What is the what are the commonalities among the countries that experience the outbreak of conflict? And we know low state capacity or low GDP per capita, low education. Mm-hmm. We know that undemocratic states or regimes that are primarily, or I should qualify that because it's both very democratic states and very autocratic states mm-hmm. are relatively stable. It's the ones that are in between that are mm-hmm. not the most repressive, but also not the ones that provide opportunities to people in terms of political participation. They right. have a higher risk right. of conflict. And I've been looking at what we often refer to as youth bulges. So I'm looking at demographic and also environmental factors. And what I find is that large proportions of youth in society are associated with a higher risk. But that risk is associated with, or it's strongly interlinked with education. So it's primarily in those areas where you have large youth populations who are not getting opportunities in terms of education, jobs, access to political participation. That's where you, you know, mobilize youth for political violence.
Right. Inclusive so, institutions.
Exactly. Right. That's an absolute key, both politically, but also socially and economically. So that's an absolute key. And now we have a project which is the flip side of that project, trying to look at how can states try to make use of what we call the demographic window of opportunity. How can they achieve a demographic dividend? How can they make use of the enormous resource that youth represent to provide for, not only manage youth, but use them or to take advantage of the fact that they're in an enormously preferable situation when it comes to possibilities for social, economic, political change. That's also something that many states aren't recognizing that potential, and aren't are more focused on managing the security aspects of large youth populations rather than taking advantage of the fact that they have enormous resource at their disposal.
And that's surprising because you just think that they would understand that. The human capital opportunities of young people is just so much greater than older. It's just basic economics.
It is very basic economics, and it's surprisingly the number of countries that fail to take advantage of being in that position.
I think of our own nation, though. I mean, we're not nearly on the same scale as a country that is, rampant with conflict. But to think that, if we investing in the youth in regards to our own educational system could be so beneficial, to think that there's economic disparities in the same city, for Tacoma, for example. There's such a vast difference between Lincoln High School and Annie Wright, when the solutions that we need as a world are embedded in any child anywhere.
And again, most countries should understand that the return on education is enormous. It's better than pretty much any other thing that you could invest in as a government aid.
Absolutely. And so to the rest of your question, we have those who are doing comparative large N work, and we have those who are anthropologists, historians, philosophers, even who are doing very detailed great casework. So for me, and going to different meetings, both internal seminars and external seminars, spend all of your time here just walking around listening to people who are doing extremely interesting work.
That they won't pay you for that. But
no, but I mean So the a lot of us are putting in more hours than we're being paid for, but it's such a privilege also to be able to do what we do. So we feel very
just
privileged.
Again, I'm an economist, when I hear you just saying you're doing statistical work, I just keep wondering, and forgive me for being technical, guys, whether the country specific dummy variable, so to speak, overwhelms a lot of the results in terms of explaining the variation in the data.
There are so many context-specific factors that are that explain a lot of the variance. There will always be.
I don't think the other things aren't important, but
I don't think you can necessarily put a number on it and say that this is the
Well, obviously, it varies from country to country.
But we're trying to also, I mean, for the purpose of designing policies and especially, you know, the identifying the factors where you may invest in education for a number of different reasons, but it also is a factor that is very strongly associated with a lower conflict risk.
Right.
So human capital development more generally is associated with lowered conflict risk. But I thought I would very much love to hear, you know, about your work as well. Make sure we have a little bit of time for that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I already introduced myself as Kwabi. My last name is Amwa Forson, and for the last several years, I've been on a mission to do two things. One is to discover what peace means to people, and asking the question hundreds of times. I've traveled the world, different countries, asking the question of what peace means to get sort of an overall consensus of the idea of what it is. And then also to put peace into action. Right. I do local humanitarian aid in Tacoma, and I'd say in the U.S. as well. Many people think of humanitarian aid being in Southeast Asia or Africa, which it is. Don't get me wrong, it is. But people need help right in the United States, you know. They think that sometimes people feel like their hands are tied. So I hope to inspire folks to look at their own skills, their ability, and to utilize that for peace. And so I drive a peace bus. It's a baby blue vehicle, and I drive it around, and I deliver socks and blankets to people on the street. Also, I've delivered books. I was Santa Claus for the city of Tacoma and delivered gifts. This sort of thing, having an idea of how I can help others and just going full for it. So far, everything's been funded by the people. I haven't received any grants or anything like that yet. Not to say that I won't pursue that in the future, but to this day, it's all been funded by the people. I'll announce a campaign. It resonates with folks.
Crowdsourcing.
Right, right. And it resonates with folks because whatever the mission is, it's in correlation with the need is at that particular point in time. And then we just push it out and see what happens, you know. Yeah. This last summer we did a campaign called Every Kid Eats. And every single day of the week there was a restaurant where kids could eat for free.
Wow.
So essentially kids ate for free in Tacoma this last summer. And I'm creating a talk show right now talking about a lot of the topics that you're getting on, you know, and just creating it in a way where your everyday person can digest it. I really like the notion of your everyday individual getting involved in peace work. Granted, a lot of the work that's being done is very complicated. As, you know, sitting here, hearing you speak and all the different things that are going into the immense amount of work you guys are doing, it's a lot. I'd like to, you know, find a way that everyone can get involved in some fashion in this work. So I think that creating a platform with influencers, philosophers, people like yourself, getting them in the room to have the most important conversation of how we're going to come together and practice peace is really important. So.
Have you seen the need for humanitarian aid sort of increase in recent years? I mean, during COVID?
It was immense.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in Tacoma, when COVID first started, our school system, it's just shut down, right? And a lot of students rely on the school system for breakfast and for lunch.
Yeah.
And they'd have designated areas throughout the city where kids could come and get food. But I thought about, what about the families that don't drive? So I took my peace bus and I started doing this breakfast fund. So families could text me at a certain time. And between, I don't know, it was like 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock, I would drive my bus and I would take it to their apartment or meet them wherever and deliver breakfast cereal. So the need became very immense during that time.
Wow. How did you, what motivated you to start doing this in the first place?
Because I could.
Yeah.
I could. And so I did it.
And then you've done the wonderful work with the restaurants. And the lunches.
Right, so that was this last summer, the Every Kid Eats campaign. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's the simple answer. The fact that the ability was there, I had the means, and a little bit of notoriety just through having a baby blue bus, right? Mm-hmm. It created sort of a fuss in the community, like, this is kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. So, yes, notoriety and popularity, how can you utilize that for the greater good? There's so many people who are well known that are just using their popularity just for popularity's sake. And I really look up to people like Muhammad Ali, who used his status in order to help people in need. And I think that's what can get the young people more involved. Sadly, maybe this isn't sadly, but young folks don't really look up to politicians so much anymore. Maybe that was how it was in yesteryear. But now they look up to, like, basketball players and musicians. Everyone's always looked up to musicians. So that being the case, how can they create this sort of trend of peace, right? To get that sort of in the know-how and in trending, right? And I think that's how we can create this sort of new movement. In the 60s and 70s, we saw this, you know, love and peace sort of, you know, flower sort of revolution. And I'd like to create a new one, but embedded in the actual steps that we have to take in order to create peace.
But you see that, I think you're absolutely right. And when it comes to sort of youth not looking up to politicians any longer, and I think that's a sad thing for the reason that I think it's a problem that politicians are becoming sort of detached from the population, and that there becomes a distance. And I think there are multiple reasons for that, but, but I think it's a fundamental problem with our political systems.
How do we gain trust? How do young folks gain trust within the political system?
Exactly. But do you see them engaged in political issues? Because you can still be engaged in political agenda and not necessarily in political parties and invested in
issues rather than parties.
Exactly. Yes. When George Floyd was killed, granted I haven't been around for too long, but I never saw a multiplicity of different youth getting together and protesting. It was wild.
And that's what keeps me optimistic, is that I see that here as well, that people are engaged in a lot of different political agendas. They're not giving up. It's not like they're becoming completely unpolitical or
I think at some level, I keep coming back to, everything we do is political at some level. The fact that you're alive, the fact that I'm alive, that's a political statement. You know, because politics reaches down to the very bottom parts of ourselves, to every part of our lives. So people who say they're not political don't understand that their actions are affected by politics all the time.
Well, everyone makes a choice whether they don't recognize it or not.
Exactly. I guess not getting involved is a choice in its own.
Absolutely. Yeah. So do you have an organization, or is it just you?
That's a good question. It's kind of a one-man show. Yeah. I don't have people working for me or anything like that. I've had friends help me out in the past, but it's primarily been myself, and whatever need is there, I'll reach out. Like, for example, with the restaurants this summer, I sat down with each restaurant individually, told them about my vision. They either were down or they weren't. So it's something I see myself continuing, maybe having volunteers in the future. I'm in flight school right now in preparation for the peace plane, right? Flying solely for peace, you know. People use aviation to transport people and bombs and guns, but I want to use it as a principle of peace to get people involved in it. You know, why would somebody use so much money and effort in order to fly a plane? So I'm hoping that it gets people who are never interested in the idea of peace involved.
That's very impressive, Kwabi.
Thank you.
So glad I had a chance to.
Yeah, this won't be the last time.
Yeah, man. Great. This is Marilyn.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I want to apologize for almost falling asleep. I can't help it sometimes.
You know, I have the same thing, especially when I'm traveling. It's so difficult to.
I'm so sorry.
No worries at all.
We talked the last time, and I'm pretty much doing the same things I've been doing before. So the radio station, that's Radio Tahoma, and that's 101.9 FM, or you can get it online. And that's a very hyper-local station. It's an educational station. It's a station to promote people who don't get their voices out, that aren't very often heard, to be heard, local poets, local musicians, local storytellers. We have a person right now from our area that's in Poland that's crossing the border to rescue animals in the Ukraine and take care of abandoned farm animals until they can come back. You know, those local stories, continuing with the Raging Grannies, although unfortunately COVID kind of played havoc with that group because they couldn't perform in person, but now they're starting to, you know, do that again. And they will continue. You know, it's women of a certain age. Grandmothers are generally considered non-threatening, so people will take the time to let their message come in. Working to connect and keep connected all the groups doing the work. So 350 Tacoma, the Puyallup Nations, Backbone Campaign, which uses artful activism, which is very attractive for drawing more people in and diversity. 350's like that too. A lot of art projects and theater projects and things like that that get people more involved. I was explaining to somebody today that personally what I want to do, what I do, is I will do specific work locally, then I will choose a project that's more national, and then something that's international, so I balance between the three so I don't burn out. Working with Jewish Voice for Peace and Veterans for Peace. And
because that's a national organization, or is it with a local chapter?
We have a local chapter in Tacoma of Jewish Voice for Peace, and we have a local chapter of Veterans for Peace.
Right.
Veterans for Peace is an amazing group. Now, I'm an associate member because I was never actually in the armed services, but that's an international group. And we had the most amazing convention just before COVID hit. It was in Spokane, and I was amazed to see people coming from Japan, to see veterans coming from all over the world to Veterans for Peace. And one of the things that was highlighted there was that the United States government had told Mexican nationals that if they volunteered to fight, that they would be granted citizenship. And then after they came to fight, they were deported back to Mexico. And so there were people, veterans, that were representing those U.S. war veterans that had been sent back to Mexico. Okinawa was very well presented because of our bases there. In Hawaii, some of the destructive planetary work that's going on there with the observatory that they want to build on Mauna Loa. There were people there that were Hawaiians that came all the way to the Veterans for Peace Conference to make their plight heard. So that's a huge gathering of people from different perspectives that have the same work to do, which is that war is not the answer. You know, that you have to look at every possible thing you can do before you consider conflict. And we know that the U.S. military-industrial complex is the fifth largest polluter on the planet. Now, this last COP27, they finally started talking openly about it. But it's taken that long for that to become part of the conversation.
No, it's extremely important that they're also held accountable in that regard. It's a major source. It's so fascinating to, I mean, with the Tacoma Peace Prize that is able to bring out all of those important local contributions that, again, tie up to important, you know, national and international causes that I think, you know, it's a little bit like the Peace Prize as well, is that, you know, we're reminded on a regular basis that there is so many extremely valuable contributions to peace, and even though we can, you know, despair about the world situation, you know, becoming more challenging, there are so many exceptionally important and strong, you know, initiatives all over the world.
Right.
And,
yeah.
I'm regularly encouraged when I have a list that I'm putting out every year on good, what would be the good candidates for the Nobel Peace Prize, and there are, you know, that's an opportunity to go through the and see some of all of, you know, some of these achievements that are so important.
I love that they chose journalism this time.
I agree. So I think the combination of last year's prize and this year's prize, with the journalists last year and then the organizations now working on both building sort of civil society resilience, but also collecting evidence of human rights abuses. That's an incredibly important
part. You've got to keep the memory.
To do that, and that is so important with all of the three laureates this year, is that that has been one of their key contributions, is to, you know, meticulously
document
and make sure that we archive the history and the memory of these atrocities.
Right. Yes.
So, yeah. So that's super important with the Sirius Prize. Mm.
You are listening to 101.9 FM KTAH LP Tacoma, Washington.
Yeah.
So what's your ambitions now? You said that you want to.
I will be in the sky by 2025. To fly the greatest flight in the history of humankind.
Great. Where is that? Where will you be going?
I don't know.
You're going to be in the sky.
I don't know where I'll be going yet, but I know that I'll have the plane by then.
Yeah, great.
And
his motto is going to be, I'm out there.
I'm out there. Yeah, that's always been my goal, even before I had the bus, was to fly for peace. But beyond that, honestly, I just want to contribute. You know, there's a lot of people are doing the work.
Mm-hmm. They are, aren't they?
Right.
It just
right.
so happens that we got picked.
Mm.
But
right.
everybody, we.
Right.
No, but again, that's one of the fascinating things about the Tacoma Peace Prize, is that it really showcases the fact that there are so many incredibly impressive people and causes and things done. You know,
it's a wonderful community.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Right. Tacoma's great. Tacoma's great. Yeah. Yeah, and so doing that and then continuing with the talk show and getting people together to have conversations about togetherness and raising awareness of mental health, gun violence, what are we going to do in order to address these issues?
Yeah.
And again, I want to keep on reiterating this, making it as simple as possible so that your average citizen feels empowered to do something about it. You know, activists are already convinced. We're already convinced. We're at the table. So how do we get your average citizen who goes to work, comes home, watches TV, to do something?
It's key. And that's why I joke and say I'm the attainable role model, because if I could do it, anybody can do it. You know, I'm not brilliant. I don't have that much energy anymore. But we can all do something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
No, I agree. And it's a sum of all those small things that really makes a difference.
And the IWW, which is something else that I'm involved with. And I know you have them here in Norway because you exported them to the United States, but I haven't found a chapter here or a branch here.
Yeah.
But the IWW has always been clear that you don't want to use academic language when you're reaching out. You want to use clear, direct, common language.
Mm.
You don't want to alienate people. You want to draw them in.
Yeah. And that's something that we are guilty of too often.
Academics,
I'm aware of it. We're trying to be conscious and trying to...
Yeah.
Because you have to balance the fact that you are, you know, when you're publishing academically,
that's
you need to relate to, you know, whatever the conventions are, but then you have to make sure that you're also able to communicate what you're doing to people outside academia. Otherwise, you know, it's going to be completely futile if we're unable to make this work accessible to people who need to understand it and hear it. So we're trying to do as best as we can, including having, you know, meetings here which also includes, you know, politicians and, you know, the guys like like Popovic, the Serbian activist, and trying to make our contributions relate to what is happening in the real world and mm-hmm. see if there is ways that we can help them with knowledge about the stuff that we were doing. So,
okay.
Can I ask a sideways question? Mm-hmm. So I haven't seen... I'm sorry.
No, you're good,
we'll get to it.
Go ahead.
Oh, that's just why I asked what kind of PhD focuses you have, because I'd imagine like a psychology... Mm-hmm. I'm a communication major.
Yeah.
I imagine that would be helpful to have along with the research majors. Because it's one thing to have the numbers, but to be able to communicate that effectively.
Yeah. So we don't have PhDs doing, and again, we don't have PhD programs at Brio. Mm-hmm. So all our PhD students are technically associated with a university. Many of them will be with the University of Oslo, but it can be also other universities. They're in a PhD program elsewhere, but they're doing their work here. And by the way, PhD students in Norway are paid so they're considered to be, you know, junior researchers. They get a payment which is comparable to what you do if it has a starting salary in the state, for instance.
Nice.
So it's not like it's not
you're not
exploiting them.
It's not a very exploitative system. Yeah. That's the core idea. So we have professional communicators here. We have a communications department consisting of four people mm-hmm. who are trained in communications. So we just got a new head of communications who's coming from the Refugee Council, who's worked extensively both with the UN and the Refugee Council and sort of on topics related to what we're doing. So they're professional on the communications, but we also had PhD students who have been technically doing their PhD at the I think it's called Department of Communications at the University of Oslo. We have PhD students who also who are working in political science or sociology, but who are studying means of communication as and for instance social media as mm-hmm. as a way of overcoming, you know, the problem of you know the fact that we're all individually, you know, trying to do something, but it's difficult to come together to do things jointly, right. and how can we create that those collective opportunities for engaging. So this is one of the, I think, slightly worrisome things is that, you know, 10 years ago we were super optimistic about the prospects of social media being a liberating technology,
right.
Because you know it would mean that students in Hong Kong could communicate and find ways to run circles around the police and same thing with many Arab countries, Arab Spring countries. But now we're seeing that the dictators are catching up and becoming much more sophisticated when it comes to technology, using facial recognition, biometrics, using AI to monitor,
alter reality.
Exactly, and so the question is, and this was one of the questions that we brought up with this democracy activist Popovich on Thursday. You know, how can the popular movements get back up on the horse and get the upper hand again mm-hmm. when it comes to using technology for democracy, for human rights? Because right now it's not looking good. So, but it's, you know, that's
I think
the,
radio is going to get more important. Yeah. It's harder to monitor.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But of course, radio can also be both a source of good and a source of bad. I mean, the way it was used in Rwanda, for instance, to build up towards the genocide was and very simple, very efficient, horrendous result.
Yeah, so, it's true.
Yeah. So, and then you were saying...
I forgot completely.
Okay.
Were there any specific findings from Popovich, the one that came through? As far as thinking and in ways of...
Well, I mean, his mantra is that you need to organize, you need to sort of build, you need to be... You need to build an organization. You cannot assume that people will just magically appear around the cause and without, you know. But I mean, sometimes you can say that you reach that threshold where people are just completely fed up with everything, and then they react. But it's usually not the way it works, right? You have to have an organization, you have to build it, and you have to do it, you know, step by step. You have to be patient, you have to be systematic in the way that you're approaching, you know, building social cohesion, building social movements. And so that's what he's trying to do now as well. And also have people and organizations securing the victories along the road, not necessarily going for the maximalist positions all the way, trying to, you know, be happy with slow progress sometimes when you can make a difference, and then, you know, try to secure that before moving on. And I think that's another sort of major important insight from the work that he's been doing.
One of the battles that we've had in Tacoma in the Pacific Northwest, and I'm sure all over the world, is the rise in homelessness. Mm. Certainly in Washington and in the Puget Sound, as rents have risen astronomically, and people haven't got rent control, and there aren't the controls on the landlords, people have landed on the streets. And one of the groups that I work with, Democratic Socialists of America, our chapter decided to take that on. And to speak to what you're talking about, we've been working to try to get the city council and the county council and eventually the state to put in place rent controls and do more social housing. But in the meantime, we found in the United States, I don't know if you have them here, but we have mobile home parks. Do you have that here?
Well, we have some sort of, well, it's usually some trailer camps, and people occasionally live in them, but it's very we have a public housing sort of arrangement, right?
Well, in Puyallup there was a mobile home park, and it was a stable community. People had bought their mobile homes and had them brought to the mobile home park, and their plan was to live there. And then the landlord of the park itself decided to sell the property and gave very little notice and told the residents they would have to move their mobile homes or just lose them, walk away from them. And, of course, the mobile homes cost thousands and thousands of dollars. Quite a few of these people were disabled. And it was the only thing they could afford, the only thing they could get into. So the DSA group decided to take that on. And that was one of our, I would call it a small victory.
Yeah, small victories are important victories.
They are important victories.
And matters to a lot of people.
We led a couple of marches and demonstrations in the park, and then went with them to city council, worked with them on how to present their situation in an appealing way. And the result was that the city council told the landlord that he had to extend the time that they had, and he had to pay them fair value for their mobile homes, which would allow them to move. Otherwise, they had no place to go, because the mobile home parks are disappearing all throughout Washington State as people are buying up this valuable property and building expensive high rises. So they were able to stay throughout Christmas.
Wow.
And they were able to get paid for their homes.
Oh, that's good.
Wow.
That's impressive.
That's a victory.
That is a victory. I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for coming. I really appreciate being able to interact with you. It's such a gem.
And the work that you're doing is so important.
Yes.
Because every little bit of knowledge that we gather through research helps the work.
We hope so. And sometimes we believe so as well.
Right.
No, I mean, it's like there is a bit of a distance from doing that academic work to eventually seeing things.
And
being
that can
used,
be discouraging when you don't see the direct.
Of course.
Yeah.
But you must start to see over time that your vocabulary becomes the vocabulary of politicians and others.
Absolutely.
You know, and that tells you that you've had an influence.
Yeah. No, and we've done a lot of things that have set a mark on, so we've been doing, I mean, one of our great concerns is the rising inequality that we're seeing many places, between groups and between social groups, between ethnic groups, and we've done a sort of a major mapping exercise just looking at how is the status of inequality around the world using data, survey data from a lot of different countries. Sure. And that went into a report that the World Bank and the UNDP did. And then this is something that is hopefully contributing to inform policies in a lot of different countries, because we're seeing that this is something that you can get knowledge about it, but so many governments are just ignoring it completely, and even refusing to look into it and document what.
In the United States, the income distribution is worse today than it was during what was called the Gilded Age.
Yeah.
Of the 1890s.
Exactly.
And so, but there seems to be almost nothing being done.
Yeah.
Again, part of it, of course, is you cannot get the two parties in Congress to agree on anything.
Well, I think, that information that you just stated, making sure that people are educated on that fact, right? We create the atmosphere of change, and the politicians follow our lead, right?
People are talking about the 99%. That is common language now.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very powerful thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, as opposed to the 1%?
There's a lot more if it's 99%.
Appreciate you for sitting down with us,
Thank you. And you were having some kind of, you said, a Christmas party tonight?
Yeah, tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So when are you heading home?
Wednesday.
No, Wednesday we go to Iceland.
Iceland, yeah.
Okay. Oh, wow. Are you going to have some time?
I'll be there for 2 days,
Great.
And then we go home.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'll be going to New York.
Yeah.
And I give a speech there about all of this amazing, inspirational...